It's Friday, May 13, 2011. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The muddy waters of the Mississippi continue to rise, threatening not only the area of the Mississippi Delta now, but far to the south, all the way to Baton Rouge and New Orleans. One of the considerations undertaken at the present is whether or not to open some of the absolutely massive spillways that could provide some relief to Baton Rouge and New Orleans, but at the same time will yield other dangers. Just consider some of these numbers. If one of these floodways, in this case the Morganza floodway, is opened up, the spillway could inundate as many as 90,000 acres of farmland almost immediately. Now, if you're talking about amounts of water here, this literally almost defies the human imagination. The Morganza spillway can divert up to 600,000 cubic feet of the Mississippi River water per second. That's per second. You know, we see so many things in this world, the created order. We look at the mountain ranges and we look at the seas, the oceans. We look at the tidal basins and we look at the estuaries and at the polar ice caps and all the rest. And the numbers literally defy the imagination. When you talk about cubic feet and cubic tons and all the rest and then square miles, well, just consider this amount of water. This amount of water, 600,000 cubic feet per second, released just by one spillway on this flooding river. This is another affirmation of the fact that we are not in control and in the greatest sense cannot be in control and will never be in control of the totality of all these figures. Nature is far larger than we are. The created order that God gave us is far larger than even his human creatures can control. The domination that is given to the human creature in the book of Genesis is a domination to subdue the earth, but we cannot subdue it fully, certainly not after Genesis 3. And certainly, even as we have control over some of these spillways, we can't keep the water from spilling somewhere. There was a very important moral event that took place in the last couple of days that ought to have our attention. It has to do with the trial that took place in Munich, Germany, a trial of a man by the name of John Demjanjuk. He's a former auto worker in Ohio. If you're old enough in America, you'll remember some of the controversies concerning Mr. Demjanjuk in years past. He worked as a guard at the Sobibor concentration camp in Nazi-occupied Poland in 1943. He has been now sentenced to 5 years in prison by this trial after he was found guilty of taking part in the murder of 28,000 persons while he was a guard at Sobibor. He was released from pretrial detention while he appeals, which could take a year. He is, by the way, 91 years old. As Jack Ewing and Alan Cole report for the New York Times, he was pushed out of the courtroom in a wheelchair. He paused briefly before cameras, saying nothing but removing the dark glasses he had worn throughout the proceedings. Now, why is this important? Well, the first line of the New York Times news story is this. In what may be one of the last major Nazi war crimes trials, a German court has sentenced Mr. Demjanjuk to 5 years in prison after finding him guilty. Those words, one of the last major Nazi war crimes trials, are necessary every time we talk about anything like this, because after all, this is a defendant who was a very young man at the time these crimes took place, and he's now 91 years old. When we think about the limitations of human justice, well, here is another story that tells us that many people die by natural causes or by other means before they can ever face the court of human justice. They, once dead, are outside our ability to try them, to find them guilty, to sentence them. Mr. Demjanjuk has here been sentenced, but it's unlikely he'll ever be able to serve even a day of that sentence because many people don't think that he would live through the appeals process. Many didn't think he would live long enough to actually reach this point in the verdict. But why is it then important to hold the trial? It's important because the demands of justice require it. If we are going to pursue justice, if we are going to say that the lives of all of those thousands of persons murdered in the Holocaust really mattered, then we have to pursue, given the greatest extent of human justice, everything that can be done in order to bring the right persons before the dock of history and before the trial of their own peers and before the public, right in the glare of international observance, to be found guilty and to be rightly sentenced. You look at the deaths here. He is now found guilty of taking part in the murder of 28,000 people. Well, how do you sentence someone rightly for having even a minuscule part in the murder of one person, much less 28,000 persons? He's been sentenced to 5 years. He almost certainly will never serve that term. But it's still right and important that he heard that verdict guilty. and that all the world knows that it happened. It may be implausible or almost impossible for many of us to remember and believe, but there are a good number of persons in this world who deny that the Holocaust ever happened, that the deaths of some 6 to 8 million human beings, mostly Jews, but also including Lithuanians and Estonians and Poles and, of course, also gypsies and homosexuals and all the rest that were included as those who were considered to have no worthiness of life. Lebens und Wertensleben was the German word, the phrase, life unworthy of life. If those lives have any meaning, it requires that we continue the pursuit of justice. In this case, this trial was necessary. So was the verdict, even if the sentence is never served. So what then is the gain? The gain is that the verdict was set down, that it was declared. In this case, thankfully, he was alive long enough to hear that verdict. It was significant that he was tracked down by persons who were seeking to prosecute and investigate these crimes decades after they took place. It's important that the United States of America cooperated in this process and that he was eventually tried in Germany, having previously been found guilty of another crime in Israel and sentenced to death. That trial then invalidated. Later, the pursuit of justice nonetheless continued. But here in the United States, there's a story that appeared over the weekend that is a similar lesson. This has to do with a young boy whose name was Johnny McCabe. He was murdered at age 15 in 1969. Murdered, we now know, by a group of other boys who were simply mad at him because he had flirted with one of their girlfriends. This is one of those stories of a 15-year-old in the wrong place at the wrong time. But more importantly, it's the story of a father who just wouldn't let it go. William McCabe is now a very elderly man. 41 years ago, he wrote about his determination to find the murderer of his son. He kept a book about Johnny's life in which he documented everything, all the way from his birth and his first steps to all the evidence that he could find concerning his son's brutal murder. Just about every day, both at morning and at night, he called the local police there in the area of Boston in order to find out if there had been any progress in his son's case. Over and over and over again, almost 42 years of phone calls and 42 years of waiting. But just recently, three men, now approximately 60 years old themselves, have been arrested, and the court believes that there is plenty of evidence that they be found guilty of this crime. Is it justice? Well, of course, there is a step toward justice here. But, of course, we're looking at four decades in which there was no justice. We're also looking at men, even if found guilty here, who'll never be able to serve out any kind of term that would meet any kind of the just requirement of the justice system for a crime such as this. But it's still right. And we look at that father's heart and his yearning to find the murderers of his son, and it is a signal to us of how we should all feel, given the full scale of visible and known human evil all around us. Another interesting story appeared in yesterday's edition of the Wall Street Journal. It turns out that Sears was selling pornography at its Sears.com website, and it did so unknowingly. Several lessons to be picked up from this. One of the things is that almost everything is available somewhere on the Internet. The Internet is a force for great good. It's one of the most magnificent ways to communicate the gospel and scriptural truth. At the same time, it is the place where almost everything is purveyed and sold and purchased and available. However, Sears.com had policies that prevented the sale of pornography. It was a group of parents who found it and brought it to the company's attention. Sears responded by removing it, as it was now being serviced by a vendor to the Sears.com site. They said, "We have a very clear policy that states the types of products we're not willing to sell. It includes pornography in every form." That's said by Imran Juma, Sears Online president. By the way, the policy also prevents offering human remains, live animals, firewood, and lottery tickets. I found that a rather strange assortment. But this tells us that this is a company that found out it was doing something that violated its policies, and it corrected it. So that's a happy story. The sad story is that the Internet is so complex that a company even like Sears.com that had very articulated policies about what it wouldn't sell found out that it actually was selling it on the Internet. It's not only buyer beware. Our motto ought to be seller beware as well. The United States is a fast-changing mission field, no doubt about that. The Wall Street Journal and other newspapers have been covering this. The best article I found was in USA Today, having to do with the fact that Indians, that is, persons from the Asian subcontinent, are now the largest group of Asians in America after only the Chinese. Now, there's been a lot of attention to the massive growth of Hispanics in the United States. That's changing our mission field, significantly changing American culture. The infusion of Hispanics is at an unprecedented rate, 43% population increase between the 2000 census and 2010. But wait just a minute. That 43% turns out to be the absolute same figure as that of the growth in the Asian population. 43%, an increase in just 10 years. The largest group, of course, is Chinese, and then Indian, and then after that will be Filipino. It is going to be a very, very interesting America we're going to face in the future. It's going to look a great deal different than the America we look at now. The question is, will our churches reflect that mission field? That's the big challenge for evangelical Christians. Another interesting story from the legal world and the world of legislation. In Texas, Governor Rick Perry is expected to sign a law requiring a woman seeking an abortion to have a sonogram and to hear a description of the fetus, including the development of the fetus, whether it has fingers, toes, or internal organs. As Anna Campoy reports for the Wall Street Journal, the goal is to improve medical care for women and to encourage them to reconsider having abortions. Now, here's why this is so important. Dan Patrick, a Republican state senator, said this, quote, "We believe that when they see the miracle of life, some will change their minds." He's got good reason to believe that. But the next paragraph ought to really have your attention. From the story in the Wall Street Journal, quote, "Abortion rights supporters say there is no evidence that sonograms, also known as ultrasounds, affect a woman's decision on abortion. And laws requiring doctors to perform the procedures, they say those laws describe and the laws that require a doctor to describe the results violate patients' rights," end quote. Well, it's hard to imagine how they would violate patients' rights, but the more amazing statement is this. Here you have abortion rights supporters saying there's no evidence that sonograms, also known as ultrasounds, affect a woman's decision on abortion. Well, that's a new argument for them, because until very recently, they've been arguing exactly the opposite. You may recall a cover story about 2 years ago in Time magazine on the ultrasound, on these imaging systems and technologies and how they are changing the game on abortion. How indeed the fact is that when many women who are even contemplating or planning to have an abortion see this life within them, they then decide they cannot do so. Once they face the reality, the image of that life that is undeniable, once they see the image of that baby, they simply cannot go through with the abortion. I see this story that tells us that abortion rights supporters are arguing against this legislation because they say it doesn't make any difference. And then I remember one of the most prominent abortion rights activists in America who in that Time magazine cover story said, quite simply, "The fetus beat us." In other words, once you can see it, the game has changed. You'll find that article linked today at my website because, I thought that article was important back when it appeared as a Time magazine cover story. And this story reminds me that it's still important now. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. And I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.